Up next, one of our favorite guests back with us, Mitch Horowitz, noted author, of course, and paranormal expert. We're going to talk about the world of the paranormal and all the interesting players who have made it what it is today. And Mitch has a handful of names, and we're going to go through them when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Mitch Horowitz. Mitch is a historian of alternative spirituality, and he is by far today's most literate voice of esoterica, mysticism, and the occult. Mitch illuminates outsider history. He explains its relevance in contemporary life. He is an author, a lecturer as well. And welcome back, Mr. Horowitz. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, George. Terrific to be here.
How have you been?
I've been great. Working hard. Hoping that the lockdown is ending, you know, here in New York City, things are beginning to open up a little bit. You know, it's what I wish for everybody listening.
You doing much travel?
Well, I actually have my first live gig in a long time booked in Kansas City in October. So knock wood, if everything holds steady, you know, I'll be seeing some of you in Kansas City.
Excellent. Excellent. What kind of event is it for you?
It's at Unity Village, and it's an event where we're going to get together for about a week in October to talk about the topic of new thought and mind metaphysics, and can your mind make things happen, and if so, why? People can learn about it on my website, MitchHorowitz.com, and I'm really excited about it.
What was it that got you interested in the paranormal, Mitch? What was that thing that happened to you?
You know, it must have been going back to when I was a little kid. I grew up in the borough of Queens in New York City. I used to take books out of the public library about the paranormal. And I remember once I took out a book of Pennsylvania Dutch folklore. And there was this pentagram inside of it. And the instructions in the book said that if you closed your eyes and you hovered a little pin above the pentagram and just brought it down randomly anywhere, it would tell you your fortune. There were these little expressions written throughout the pentagram. So I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I followed the instructions. I closed my eyes. I brought down the pin, and it said, a letter. You will receive a letter. So I thought, okay. Literally, the very next day, a letter arrived, and it was a notice for an overdue book from the same library. So
there you go.
It was kind of curious, and what can I say? You know, it's one of these little things that happen to you when you're a kid, but it started a lifelong fascination.
We're going to kind of do a history lesson in the paranormal today. This is interesting and fun because I've never done a show like this. Well, we're going to talk about the really chief players of the paranormal since the 1800s.
Yeah.
And have you explain who they are and stuff. And, of course, when we take calls the next hour with people, they will be able to ask you about these individuals as well. And let's start by the word paranormal itself. How did that start? Any idea?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, it was really in the late 19th century. You had figures like Frederick Myers and William James. These were some of the people who started the original Society for Psychical Research. And, you know, they and their colleagues came up with terms like the paranormal or parapsychology or subliminal mind. You know, believe it or not, nowadays we talk about the subconscious, the unconscious. But it was really only as recently as the 1890s that people in the West began to have an understanding of those concepts. And it came out of the work of a lot of people from that original Society of Psychical Research. They're the ones that started to make the study of hauntings and apparitions and ESP into a real science.
Frederick Myers was a British scientist, and he researched life after death. He got into that in a big way, didn't he?
He really did. He had a passionate belief that there exists after-death survival, and that we could prove it. So he began to structure experiments in the late 19th century where, for example, a person who was near death might disclose to Frederick Myers a certain word or a code or the combination to a lock. And then the effort was made to see if somebody could glean that information who had no other way of knowing it. Or Myers would track cases where a deceased person would apparently reappear as an apparition and disclose some information to somebody who would have no other way of knowing it. Or there might be multiple witnesses. You know, somebody might show up as an apparition or some sort of a ghost or an afterlife presence, and multiple people would see it. And so Myers would catalog hundreds and hundreds of cases like that. He would look for correspondences, and he would try to find things that were so incredible that if you were to dispel them as nonsense, or if you were to dispel them as fraud, you would actually have to come up with a more complicated solution than accepting that there can be afterlife survival. And that was his primary work.
Was he accepted in his day?
He was not accepted, but he had such a powerful intellect that he also could not be dismissed. He was close friends with the American philosopher William James, who was a big supporter of Myers' work. And Myers is still read today. You can be sure he was mocked, he was ridiculed, he was dismissed. But, you know, it's funny, George, you know, there's a certain justice in posterity. I mean, the man died in 1901. His great book, which is called Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death, didn't even come out until 2 years after his death. So he might have died feeling that his work was a failure, but here we are in the early 20th century talking about Frederick Myers. There's a whole new audience being exposed to this man today. So, you know, over the course of well more than a century, he's remembered and his critics are not.
Charles Fort, where they got the word Fortean, was a giant in the paranormal.
Yeah, Charles Fort is a real hero to me. He was a writer here in New York City, where I live, did a lot of his work at the New York Public Library, where I also do a lot of my work. And Charles Fort published a book in 1919 called The Book of the Damned. And by damned, he meant the excluded. He meant people and stories who were rejected. And Fort put together story after story after story of strange, weird, anomalous phenomena, spontaneous combustion, mysterious lights in the sky. He was one of the first people who wrote about what we would call UFOs, strange beasts, instances where people reported just weird anomalies like the raining of frogs and things like that. And Fort's life's purpose was to poke holes in the straight story of science. He said, look, you know, we live in this age of materialism where we feel we have it all figured out, but there is a constant, steady stream of reports from around the world of anomalous phenomena that don't fit the straight story of science. These are things that Fort called the damned, things that were rejected. And he said, we have to poke holes in orthodoxy. Science has become a kind of orthodoxy, and I'm going to keep coming up with account after account from newspapers, from eyewitnesses, from testimony that proves that we don't understand everything that's really out there.
Was Ripley also a paranormal expert?
Well, yes and no. You know, Ripley was an interesting man. He traveled the world in search of anomalies, found and curated a lot of strange things. You know, I don't think he would have classified himself exactly as someone who is into the paranormal, but he was dedicated to documenting really weird, strange, and unbelievable practices.
You mentioned philosopher William James, who also, and a lot of people didn't know this, was into the occult.
Absolutely. And William James is hands down my absolute hero. William James was very dedicated to studying mediums and channelers and raising the question of whether there were certain people who could receive communication from beyond the grave. He was very interested in early ESP research, and he was also very interested in the mind's ability to heal the body and the mind's control over the body. Now, when James was living, he died in 1910. When James was living, we didn't really have the modern field of placebo research, but he foresaw placebo research, and the fact is, that field is making strides today that he never would have dreamt of. We have studies that have demonstrated the effectiveness of placebo surgeries. It absolutely boggles the mind. But there was a veteran center in Colorado which several years ago did a study on a group of patients who were scheduled to have knee surgery to relieve arthritic pain. And they took one group of patients, and they performed the standard knee surgery, and they took another group of patients, and they performed just a benign incision, just a simple flesh wound. The rates of recovery were more or less the same. We actually have evidence of the effectiveness of placebo surgeries. These are the kinds of things that William James foresaw. He thought there might have been a spiritual effect at work, and that's a very open question, because prayer and the religious appeal, they do have a definite effect on the body.
Well, these people we've talked about to date right now, have they all been very spiritual and God-loving?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I mean, William James certainly would have described himself as a spiritual person, and he made an interesting observation. He said, you know, I see no reason why the very fact of believing in something, including the concept of God, including spiritual concepts, doesn't actually really truly strengthen the effects of that force in your body and in your life. And that may be more than just a psychological effect, but it may be that belief in religion itself strengthens religion as a force in your existence. That was one of James's contentions.
The Austrian neurologist Sigmund Freud, many people believe, was just a clinician, except with his interpretations of dreams and things like that. He touched on ESP a little bit, didn't he?
He really did. He really did. You know, Freud made a decision at a certain point in his career when he was young that he was not going to be involved in the occult, that he was not going to be involved in ESP studies, and he and Carl Jung had a big split over this. But the fact is, early in his life, Freud was a member of the British Society of Psychical Research, and he wrote a paper in 1922 about dreams and ESP, and he believed that there were instances where people had premonitory dreams, precognitive dreams, and that the dream state could be prime time for ESP phenomena. And early on in his career, Freud felt that psychoanalysis might help bring some of this to light. But he made a political decision, and that was that he wanted psychoanalysis to be accepted as a mainstream medical art, so he distanced himself from the occult. But when he was a young man, he was much more open to it.
What happened between him and Carl Jung? They were once close, weren't they? Wasn't Jung his student?
Absolutely. Not only was Carl Jung Freud's student, but he was his most promising student. He was his heir apparent. But Jung was deeply interested in questions of ESP and premonition, in apparitions, in what he called synchronicity, which were meaningful coincidences, let's say. And, you know, I don't think Freud, on a personal level, was really hostile to all that stuff, because, again, when he was a young man, he was interested in ESP. But he was very dedicated to framing psychoanalysis as a mainstream medical art. He felt Jung endangered that. So the two had a split, and it was never healed.
We're talking with Mitch Horowitz about the players in the paranormal. Later on tonight, we'll talk about some of dreams and miracles, that the things he has also worked on. And, of course, we'll take your phone calls here on Coast to Coast next hour. Two incredible researchers, J.B. Rhine and Louisa Rhine. I never had the opportunity of interviewing. They passed away before I really got going. But you've looked into their careers.
Yeah, they are a huge inspiration to me. J.B. and Louisa Rhine, husband and wife team of scientists, opened the parapsychology lab at Duke University in the 1930s. And as far as I'm concerned, at least here in the United States, they were the ones who really made study of ESP into a science. And I tell you, George, J.B. conducted so many experiments so carefully and with such clinical excellence for decades, and he found statistical evidence dead to rights and as good as any that we have that there are certain individuals who are capable of gleaning information in a laboratory setting in ways that go beyond the five senses. He tested people very frequently using decks of cards, asking people to make hits, guesses on decks of cards. And that wasn't the only method he used, but that was his primary one. And he found over and over again that there were certain individuals that kept getting hit rates that went statistically beyond guess rates. And there was just no two ways about it. Some of us are capable of gleaning information in ways that go beyond the ordinary senses. And J.B. was so meticulous, and he was so careful. He was the one who actually popularized the term ESP. And he created a body of statistical evidence that placed it beyond question that some faculty of ESP exists and can be documented among human beings.
Is the Ryan Research Center still around?
It is still around. I've spoken there. I've spoken at fundraisers there. It is located off campus. There was a changing of the guard in the administration at Duke University during JB's lifetime. And by the late 60s, he was having difficulty getting along with some of the new administrative figures at Duke.
So he kind of broke away. Okay, he broke away from the university?
Yes. So now it still exists as a not-for-profit off campus, although they do events with Duke University.
Did you ever look into the work of Ed and Lorraine Warren?
Oh, the Warrens I haven't studied too closely, actually. I'm very interested in them, but I'm just at the beginning of looking into their work.
Most of the people we're talking about tonight have passed on, but a few are still around, including the scientist Jacques Vallée, who's been on our program several times.
Yes, Jacques is a friend of mine, and I've had the privilege of working with him. Jacques is, in addition to being one of the pioneers of the Internet, probably, I think, the greatest living researcher of UFOs today. And Jacques' theory behind UFOs, I think, it's become more widely accepted, and I think it's ultimately the theory that most people are going to gravitate towards. And Jacques' theory is simply that UFOs, what we call UFOs, are interdimensional beings, that it would be easier to theorize ways in which we could be experiencing close encounters with beings from other dimensions than it would be to theorize that we're being visited by extraterrestrials from vast, vast distances. And in the late 1960s, Jacques theorized that what we call ETs and UFOs are figures from other dimensions. And the truth is, in our own era, with advances in quantum mechanics and string theory and time-space relativity, people have largely come to accept that the interdimensional thesis is real. Whether we're being visited by beings from other dimensions is still theoretical, but that was the insight that Jacques brought to the UFO question.
The late Dr. J. Allen Hynek wrote a book called Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which Steven Spielberg turned into a blockbuster movie. But in that movie, they had a Frenchman by the name of Lacombe, who Jacques Vallée was basically styled after his life, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. The character of Lacombe from Close Encounters was styled after Jacques Vallée. And Jacques told me that he had discussed this interdimensional thesis with Spielberg, and Spielberg agreed with it. And one of the greatest pleasures of my life, George, was getting to watch Close Encounters with Jacques Vallée.
Did he like the part of the Frenchman?
Oh, yeah, he loved it, and we had a good time.
And he realized that was him, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, he knew it dead to rights. He knew it dead to rights. And he's friendly with Spielberg. So, you know, I mean, he was in on the whole thing. And Alan Hynek is also represented dramatically in that film. It's a great film. When I was a kid growing up,
it was a classic.
I was more into that film than I was into Star Wars. That probably helped set me on the path.
Me too. And Dreyfus did a great job in that. Did Vallée know J. Allen Hynek?
Oh, yeah, they worked together. I mean, in some ways, Vallée was a protege of Hynek, and, you know, he recognized Hynek as a giant. You know, Hynek was the one who studied UFOs originally.
Wasn't a believer in the beginning.
Was not a believer in the beginning. Brought the meticulousness and the conservatism of a real scientist to the question. He became a believer. Alan Hynek was the one who created the classification system of close encounters of the first kind, second kind, and so forth. And just like J.B. Ryan made study of ESP into a science, Alan Hynek made study of UFOs into a science. We owe a lot to him.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more about J. Allen Hynek when we come back after the break, Mitch. Would you give out your website to folks who are interested in your work?
Sure thing. Website is mitchhorowitz.com. You'll find lots of lectures and articles up there. My email is up there. I'm always happy to hear from Coast listeners.
A couple of Mitch's books include The Seeker's Guide to the Secret Teachings of All Ages and The Miracle Month, 30 Days to a Revolution in Your Life. We're going to come back in just a moment and chat more with Mitch Horowitz. We'll take calls with him next hour about the unusual and the paranormal. We've still got some more paranormal names to go through, and then we'll talk a little bit about his work with miracles on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take your paranormal calls with Mitch Horowitz next hour here on Coast to Coast. Still more things to talk with him about when we come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Mitch Horowitz with us, and we'll take your calls with Mitch next hour as we talk about the paranormal world. Let's talk a little bit about J. Allen Hynek again, Mitch, and then we'll get into some other individuals. Hynek, of course, was not a believer, was part of the Project Blue Book for the Air Force, but there was a case called the Socorro, New Mexico case with a police officer named Lonnie Zamora, who has since passed on.
Yes.
And that case convinced Hynek that UFOs and visitations were real. And he changed his entire career. He formed the Center for UFO Studies out of Chicago. It was dramatic, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. And, you know, one of the things that Hynek was able to do was create a standard and a methodology for classifying UFO eyewitness accounts. He looked for corroboration. He looked for people who were not sort of addicted to phenomena, who had nothing to gain materially or otherwise by making these claims. He looked for multiple witnesses. He looked for physical evidence. He looked for consistency in physical evidence. And, of course, he looked for objects on radar. And he did an extraordinary job cataloging legitimate, verifiable UFO sightings. And the truth is, George, you know, we're living through an era right now where Allen Hynek's work has been validated. You know, people are reading about UFOs on the front page of the New York Times.
That's
and watching
right.
UFO videos at CNN.com. No serious person at this moment in time questions that we are looking at engineered phenomena. These aren't mistakes or delusions or swamp gas or what have you. Denying UFOs is part of the past now. You know, in our own generation, we have gone through the mainstreaming of UFOs. The work of Allen Hynek has been supported. We don't know what they are. Are these extraterrestrial visitors? Are these some sort of secret project? Is this stuff from other dimensions? I mean, there are more questions than we can tabulate, but that UFOs exist, no serious person doubts.
You talk a lot on this program about Manly P. Hall. He was one of the giants of the American occult scene.
Yeah, Manly P. Hall was a Canadian-born occult philosopher and writer who spent most of his life here in the United States. He died in 1990. And Manly P. Hall is most famous for writing a monumental book called The Secret Teachings of All Ages. It came out in 1929. The man was only 27 years old when he published this book. It is a massive and really epic encyclopedia of occult and esoteric philosophy. It's one of the greatest books of its kind that's ever been written, and it's a mystery how a 27-year-old with no formal schooling, no formal education, and obviously no access to the kinds of information that we have at our fingertips today could have written such a monumental work. It's a true mystery. He was an extraordinary figure. He was a great inspiration to me, and I just view him as the dean of esoterica, the dean of the American occult. There was never anyone like him.
You quote him a lot, don't you?
Oh, I do. You know, I mean, he was really the figure who put me on my path. He died in 1990, and I never had the opportunity to meet him, but he was the one who made me realize that you could pursue writing about occult and esoteric history as a real vocation in and of itself, and you didn't need the approbation of universities. You didn't need any title. I don't have any title. You could be an independent historian, and you could make your mark, and he inspired me on my career path.
You have looked into the work of a French mind theorist, Émile Coué. Tell us about him.
Émile Coué was one of the absolute greats. He was a self-educated hypnotist and mind theorist who lived in northwestern France. And Émile Coué, although his name is not widely known to people, is famous for having introduced a little mantra into everyday life, and that is, day by day, in every way, I am getting better and better. And he told people, use that mantra and you will feel better. You will stand taller. You will be more confident. And, of course, the critics rolled their eyes and said, that's silly. You know, how can anything so simple really work? But what they misunderstood is that Kuei advised using that mantra as a kind of self-hypnosis. He gave specific instructions that you should whisper it to yourself very gently 20 times just before falling asleep at night, and again, 20 times just upon waking up in the morning. The fact is, Kuei grasped something that neuroscientists didn't realize until more than a generation later, and that is, when you're in a very relaxed state, just before you drift off to sleep at night, it's a state that sleep researchers call hypnagogia. Yep. It's a highly, highly suggestible state. It's a state very similar to what you're in when you undergo hypnosis. And you can experience hallucinations in that state, waking dreams, but you still have conscious control over your mind. That is prime time for introducing new suggestions to yourself. So that's the time period that Kuei said you should use his little mantra, day by day, in every way, I am getting better and better. It's just something to try. It's a wonderful experiment. A lot of people swore by it, and a lot of Kuei's insights actually helped inform some of the advances that we're seeing in placebo studies today, because he was also a pharmacist, and he made many observations about different ideas and suggestions that could help heighten the effectiveness of medications among some of his clients. And some of Kuei's very insights have been validated in the past several years by the Harvard program in placebo studies. I spoke to the director, and he agreed with me about Kuei's early insights.
He had an effect on the Beatles, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. You can hear Kuei's expressions in some of the Beatles' lyrics. The Beatles have a song, It's Getting Better. You know, got to admit it's getting better. It's getting better all the time. You gave me the word. I finally heard. I'm doing the best that I can. That's a reference to Emil Kuei. And John Lennon also made references to Kuei in some of the songs from his solo career.
That's cool. Now, what about his impact on ESP studies?
Oh, you know, Kuei had such an incredible impact on ESP studies. Again, you know, he died. He died in 1926. So he died before ESP as a scientific field had fully taken shape, at least here in the United States. But what Kuei discovered was that this state that we're in just before we drift to sleep, this state that we call hypnagogia, it's a very unique, subtle time. It's a time when our mind acts in unusual ways because we're hovering between wakefulness and sleep, so our rational barriers are down and different ideas and possibilities can come through. Many, many years after Kuei's death, there was another paranormal pioneer, a great ESP researcher named Charles Honnerton. And Charles Honnerton found that if you could induce people into a very relaxed state, just hovering on sleep, but not crossing over into sleep, just hovering on it, you could increase instances of ESP and telepathy in such subjects. And Honnerton did a series of experiments where he would induce a subject into a very, very relaxed state, just near the border of sleep. And he would have another subject that would mentally attempt to send images to the subject that was in this state of relaxation. And he found over and over again in thousands of cases a higher than average bump in people being able to identify the correct image from this state of hypnagogia. And we all go through it. We go through it twice a day, just as we're drifting to sleep at night, just as we're coming to in the morning. So it appears to be a heightened state for ESP, and it appears to be a state from which we can introduce new suggestions into our subconscious.
Our friend Raymond Moody, of course, coined the phrase near-death experiences, was just on our program. Yeah, you think the world of him.
Enormously, enormously. Raymond Moody is such a pioneer, and he was the one that gave us the ability to talk about these experiences that people have of conscious awareness when they have undergone bodily death, including brain death. And he cataloged, he's an MD, and he cataloged experience after experience of people being able to accurately identify things that are being said in the room, people who are in the room, physical objects and details from rooms that they have been in, maybe an operating room, maybe a hospital room, maybe a mortuary, after they have been declared dead. And, you know, when he first pioneered this theory of near-death experiences in the 1970s, again, he too was dismissed. You know, this was considered ridiculous, but by the medical establishment. But in private, of course, there are lots of people in the medical establishment who will repeat stories like Moody's, and there are lots of people from all different backgrounds, all different religious points of views, who report near-death experiences.
I've got a guest tomorrow, Stephen Mark Weiss, who's going to talk about reincarnation, Mitch. You've looked at that with the scientist Ian Stevenson, who passed away 14 years ago.
Yes. Ian Stevenson was a remarkable figure. He was a professor at the University of Virginia, dedicated his entire life to studying cases of supposed reincarnation. And the brilliant innovation that Stevenson brought to the field of reincarnation studies is that he found dozens and dozens of cases where different children would record past life experiences, and they had birthmarks. They had birthmarks on their bodies that corresponded to birthmarks or physical injuries that had appeared on the bodies of people who they claimed to have been in past lives. And there was no way to fake these things. Now, we don't actually know where birthmarks come from or why they manifest, why they appear. And Stevenson found more than 40 cases, probably 50 cases by the time of his death, of children who had birthmarks and had stories of past lives, and Stevenson was able to identify the people who these children claimed to be in past lives, and he found corresponding birthmarks on their bodies or injuries like shotgun wounds or some sort of mutilations that corresponded to the birthmarks that these kids were born with. And there are just certain cases where past life stories have been backed up by actual physical correspondences.
What do you believe of reincarnation?
I really think reincarnation is a very, very tempting possibility, and I'll tell you why. And I was inspired in this by the paranormal writer Hans Holzer. All of us go through life with certain traits that just seem unchangeable. You know, there are certain behavioral traits, behavioral patterns, that are with us for all our lives, no matter what we do. We can go through therapy. We can go through religious conversions. We can talk to friends about it. But there are certain traits, certain personality patterns that seem absolutely fixed. If you were to look for the simplest solution that would cover all the bases of the persistence of these characterological traits, reincarnation would be perhaps the simplest blanket solution for why temperaments and character traits seem to enter life with us and follow us throughout life. The fact is, people of different religions around the world throughout human history have believed in reincarnation. It's at the basis of the Hindu faith, perhaps the oldest faith on earth, and a faith that commands the allegiance of hundreds of millions of people. If humanity's ancient belief in reincarnation is correct, it would go a long way in explaining why certain character and psychological traits seem present in us as infants and follow us throughout our entire lives.
You know, the James Randi was a skeptic.
Yeah.
He died a, you know, bitter man in 2020, not too long ago. You weren't a fan of his either.
No. I view Randi less as a skeptic than as a cynic. I view him as somebody who was more interested not in winning a debate with people like me or in winning a debate with people who study parapsychology, but in there being no debate.
Right. Debunking.
Yes. Just wiping out the legitimacy of all the research that we've been talking about. And I wrote an article about James Randi that appeared shortly after his death called The Man Who Destroyed Skepticism. Because my contention is, and I write about it in detail in this article, and some people love it, some people are deeply critical of it. I didn't write it for anybody to like me, but I wrote it because I thought justice needed to be done for some of the people who Randy had ridiculed. And I think his methodology was very frequently corrupt. I think his own standards were from time to time directly and deliberately misleading, in some cases fraudulent. He was so hell-bent on discrediting and disproving ESP research, the study of paranormal phenomena, the study of anomalies in parapsychology, that he would engage in what I regard as really unprincipled smear campaigns against some of the principal researchers, including some of the folks that I've just mentioned. Now, I wrote this article, and some people were very angry at me for it, but the fact is, I didn't write it out of anger. I didn't write it out of vindictiveness. I realize there are people who love this man, and when a human dies, there are tragedies, and there are relationships, and there are people left behind. I wrote it because he based his career in large measure on smearing some people like a J.B. Ryan or
Uri Geller.
Stevenson. Geller and he were in perpetual battle. Rupert Sheldrake, the British scientist. There were a whole wide range of people who were really responsible, decent, meticulous researchers who cared very deeply about getting to the truth. They were conservative in their research, and Randy would caricature and smear them. And I just feel the need to defend the lives and reputations of some of these people, and that led me to some very deep criticism about James Randi. The article is called The Man Who Destroyed Skepticism. It's very easy to find online. It's also linked up at my website.
Would you have loved to have debated him?
I certainly would. I certainly would. I would have welcomed a debate with James Randi. You know, there was such a difference in our careers and our generations that we never crossed paths that way. I find it really difficult to find people in the skeptic community to debate because I want to talk about these things in a serious way with real standards and with a real structured way of talking about what's real, what's not, what conforms to science. Are there areas that we can agree? I won't just talk to somebody who's a cynic. I won't just talk to somebody who is a polemical science blogger. I want to sit down and I want to talk to somebody who's studied the material and has a real question. If we can have an honest debate, I'm not interested in winning. I'm interested in there being a real dialogue.
Well, and you do a great job. Mitch, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and take phone calls. Then I want to talk with you about miracles as well on Coast to Coast AM.